Good morning. I am Kathy Gowdy, Colorado 28436, alternate defense counsel at trial and on appeal from Ms. Shawnee Ryan, the defendant here today. I would like to first address the issue of the merger of counts. The briefing left it in somewhat a state of flux. There, however, has been a case that the Attorney General did file, issued after the reply brief. That was filed as a supplement, and it is People v. Rhea. In that case, the one quote that is extremely important is, where, as here, multiplicity is both raised before trial and clear at that time, multiplicitous counts should be eliminated before trial, because doing so would avoid the due process inquiry discussed below. In this particular case, it was raised by written motion, it was raised by oral motion at the midtime in the motion for judgment of acquittal, and it was preserved. However, because the judge at the conclusion did indeed merge the sentencings, not the convictions, but the sentencings, to only be for two that fell within the 6 months period, I do not believe that double jeopardy, the second prong of the analysis, does apply, which is why it was not raised. However, the minimus is incorrect, because the minimus reflects seven convictions. It does not reflect two convictions with two sentences. So Ms. Ryan goes into the prison with seven felony convictions on her record. The only thing merged is the sentencing. I would ask this court issue a corrected minimus, as it is the power to do, and remove those counts, which I believe are 2 and 3, and 5, 6, and 7, as they should not have been allowed to remain on a record. If this had been properly charged, she would then have had only two counts at which she would have been tried, two counts that she might have been convicted on, two counts for sentencing. And that would have been only two convictions.
Ms. Gowdy, do you agree that at the actual sentencing hearing, the court did merge the convictions, but it just did not show up on the minimus?
It said it merged the sentencing. There was talk about merging the convictions, but it did not occur. The record shows that they all still show on the sentencing minimus as a conviction felony, F4, F4, F4.
Okay.
Next, as this is a rather complicated case, if you have questions, please jump in on that, because I don't know if I'm going to make it through all the issues in the time. Next is the 806 admission of her prior conviction. This is disputed by the Attorney General, but also by alternate defense counsel. No statements of Ms. Ryan were elicited. No statements of Ms. Ryan were testified to by the witness on the stand. So 806 did not apply at that time, because 806 clearly states hearsay statements or non-hearsay statements would be a statement of the defendant. But none were asked for, none were elicited, and none were stated. We do not have Ms. Ryan said this. What we have is her actions. She wanted an investigation, but we don't have her statements.
Ms. Gowdy, if we assume that that was error, does the later decision of the defendant to testify basically render that moot or cure that error?
No, the decision to testify is constitutional, and I don't see how it can be mooted. When she was asked about it, she said, the conviction, that cat is out of the bag, I wish I weren't doing this.
But that wasn't the only reason that she stated that she chose to testify, correct?
No, she stated other reasons in follow-up as well, but the primary reason she stated and the first one up was that her conviction was already before the jury and she had to explain. So I believe that the Curtis advisement was then tainted, because she knew the conviction was already in. It was the only thing she could do. An error of the trial court should not be able to trump a constitutional right to remain silent. Secondly, under Doar, the case that the judge made the decision upon, the language is clear in Doar that the conviction comes in for a defendant where the defendant has elected not to testify. This happened before the Curtis advisement, before even the defense case had started. We didn't know. There had not been an election to not testify. And so it was premature. Would it have come in? Who knows? Had she gotten her right to a defense and all those statements come in, I would not be arguing that here today. But she was not permitted to put her statements in, her defense. That's under the argument of right to present a defense. And yet she still had the conviction put in for what were basically actions, and it was put in prematurely because she had not yet elected to testify or not to testify. DORA is there to protect against defendants, as the DA said in this case, backdooring in evidence. But we don't know, because the judge made an error and admitted the conviction. A felony conviction is presumptively harmful, and it should not have been admitted. It affected the jury's deliberations. And again, I would just simply state under 806, statements were not elicited. No statements were questioned or asked for. And that is primary for the timing of it.
But it can't be conduct, can't it? Can't that be hearsay for purposes of 806? It's not simply relegated to spoken words, is it?
Generally, you know, hearsay can be that, but in the Rule 806 itself, the first sentence says, when a hearsay statement, it doesn't say or action or doesn't say hearsay, it says a hearsay statement. And the emphasis on statement and the purpose of it is to not get in somebody testifying when they're not testifying. The rule is just so clear that the error is palpable in this case.
Ms. Gowdy, let me then ask you then, if through the cross-examination of the prosecutor's investigator, they elicited that Ryan had told agencies that her business was being tampered with, would you characterize that as not being a statement?
It's great. It's gray, but it was not a statement because I believe the question asked what action she wanted, what was done, what was on the tampering. Tampering became sort of a word of art in this trial because that was what the defendant believed her defense was to be. But it was not a statement. It was not saying, Shawnee Ryan said this is tampering, that her business is destroyed. It was her action seeking a police investigation against the people she believed had victimized her.
Okay, and then also it was elicited that she did name one of the individuals as being primarily responsible for bringing charges against her.
But the question was not who did she name or what did she say. Mm-hmm. It was Marianne Virgili was brought up in this. It was not a specific question as to her statement. It was to her actions or to what the context was that the investigator was operating under. It was not statements.
Okay,
thank you. The court also, in this case, admitted 13 acts of other acts under 404B and res gestae. This was also an error of the trial court, should be reviewed for abuse of discretion. The acts themselves that were admitted were no more similar in state to the continuing course of conduct in the 7 counts she was already facing. Acts that were admitted were like that she took in artwork. She had a small store and she took in artisans' work and then would sell that to the people of Aspen for their decoration of very lovely and high-end houses. Some people she took the artwork, returned it damaged. Some people she didn't return the artwork at all and said she had sold it. Some type of the 404B was for deposits that she took but never ordered the object or ordered it and it was substandard. But none of these are similar. The only similarity in the 404B, and this is really the underlying undercurrent of this entire case, was her reaction whenever confronted on anything, not just her clients, but it was a very aggressive stance. It was a very uncivil behavior. Barrages of emails, letters, and attacks. But that was not what was raised because that was not the course of conduct. The course of conduct in this case was theft, pure and simple. 7 counts of theft that should have been 2. and that was not enhanced, and that was, the jury was not helped by hearing from an artist whose tile table was damaged, and as she took it out in the rain, and Ms. Ryan was berating her. The sheer overwhelming level of it creates a situation where she could not have received a fair trial. And under the doctrine of usum from the Colorado Supreme Court, this 404B was improperly admitted. The res geste was not res geste. The res geste was old. And overall, that was improper. It also then tied into her right to present a defense being violated in that she had responses on that. She had her evidence of a pact by people, 20 to 44 people, who signed a letter and sent it to the court. The court under 404B let the attorney's cover letter in as evidence where it's outlined, but did not permit the exhibits Ms. Ryan wanted in that showed the actual events that happened. One of them was a woman who didn't get her wages. One woman lost her cell phone number. But these are not 404B. These are not similar acts. They have to be similar. They have to have some bearing and relevancy to the case as charged, and these did not. It simply permitted in all of the bad behavior of Ms. Ryan, all of her incivility, but it did not permit her to present her reasons for how she believed this or why she reacted in the way she did, which, had she been able to present it, was that she was defending her family and her business. And she stated as much at the sentencing hearing. And in fact, at the sentence hearing, one of the 404B witnesses was the only one that came to testify at the sentencing and talked about the pact, that it in fact happened. There had been meetings. People organized to take down Ms. Ryan's business and Ms. Ryan. So it was, you're only paranoid until they get you, I guess, would be the lesson from that. With that, I would ask to reserve my remaining 3 minutes for rebuttal, should I require. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gowdy.
Good morning. May it please the court. Kevin McReynolds, Colorado Bar number 40948, on behalf of the people. I'd like to also start with the merger issue. This was an issue that would have been an issue of first impression when the answer brief was filed in April. The Rea decision came out May, which was actually a month before the reply brief was filed in this case on June 23rd. Rea was not addressed in the reply brief. I'm hearing these arguments for the first time. I did not bring the mitimus with me. If the mitimus is incorrect, the people would agree with that. The sentencing hearing, everyone was very clear. There are two convictions and two sentences because the timing of the thefts in this case, the seven charge counts, took place between November 2007 and June of 2009. And if you look at the ranges of those thefts, because these were ongoing relationships, they were ostensibly business relationships, there were sometimes ranges. And if you look at that, in order to maximize the jury verdict, as the court did in People v. Vigil, where we were dealing with the same issue with the post-Lucero merger of in the theft counts, based on what the Supreme Court decided was a prosecutorial unit of theft. To maximize those jury verdicts, it is two counts, and it should be two counts and two sentences. She received the two sentences. It was my understanding she received the two convictions, but they should be merged for both conviction and sentencing purposes. And I don't believe that there's any other issue to be addressed on that.
Mr. McReynolds, I think it's fairly clear that the merger ultimately addressed a double jeopardy violation.
Yes, Your Honor.
However, I guess my question is there some sort of inherent prejudice in asking a jury to return seven convictions as opposed to one or two convictions with multiple victims?
And that was another issue that was resolved in Rea. You're aware of that because I argued that to you. Yes, there is also a due process analysis that needs to be done when there is this type of a scenario where we do have multiplicitous charges which are sent to the jury and then are only corrected post-verdict. But the two primary concerns there are, is there a compromise verdict or would the evidence have been different if the counts were presented in their prosecutorial unit as opposed to in the way that they were presented? Neither one of those issues arise here. She was convicted of all seven counts. The exact same evidence would have come out regardless of how it was packaged. And in fact, additionally, as in Rhea, there was also a separate charges instruction, which instructed the jury that you're to consider each charge on its own. And had they only found two charges, which were not 6 months with each other, like counts one and seven, she would be facing the same convictions here, even if she'd been acquitted of two through six. I'll move on to the door issue. I'm hearing the way it's being presented for the first time here. The reply brief was focused very much on the order of presentation, which the Krueger case shows is not the relevant inquiry. The relevant inquiry is, did we get out information that were the hearsay of the defendant? And we did. It was the August 10th, 2012, pages 16 through 25, the cross-examination of the DA investigator. What happened there was that Ms. Ryan's counsel asked a series of questions of the investigator, asking for the essence of what it was Ms. Ryan had been complaining about to police. Didn't she come to police? Didn't she want to file a complaint? Who was it she wanted to name as the ringleader of this conspiracy against her? What were the nature of her allegations? And he testified, what I understood from reading the reports to the police office she was contacting, the essence was she was a victim of her victims. Her victims had conspired against her to defame her business, and then additionally got him to confirm the nature of the blog posts that she was complaining about, which was here a couple layers of hearsay there. These blog posts about what her victims had been complaining about online, about her treatment of them, her taking money for goods that she never ordered, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's really trying to split hairs a bit too fine to suggest that somehow she could get all of her allegations about what it was that these people were doing to her through this investigator, through this cross-examination, and now claim, but those weren't statements. That wasn't an argument that was presented and wasn't something that I'd seen in the opening brief or the reply brief. It's for hearing it for the first time here, I don't think it's accurate. I don't think that's what Dorr says. I don't think that's what Krueger says. If you get out the information of what it is the defendant was saying, that it's self-serving, hearsay. You are allowed to be impeached with your conviction at that point. Moving to the point of mootness, it is moot. The decision of whether or not to testify is a separate tactical decision that needs to be made based on what choices the defendant has before them. In this case, she very much wanted to present her theory that she was being tampered with, that she was the victim here, that these people were engaged in conspiracy against her. It was presented throughout in her opening argument, through obtaining her self-serving hearsay through the DA's investigator. And after having gotten it in, she then testified to explain the context. To the extent she's arguing, well, I should have been allowed to get even more in, number one, it's a little difficult to tell from the scant opening brief exactly what she's complaining about. I think it's mostly Detective Hassel who was not allowed to be subpoenaed to testify about her direct complaints to him because it was self-serving hearsay. She got all of her complaints in. She testified, she explained what all of her complaints were. To the extent she's arguing, I should have been allowed to present this other evidence of what I told people, that was hearsay. I still have not heard a single argument as to why it would not be hearsay or why it was admissible. And I think that is all the reason to affirm with regard to the right to present a defense. the Curtis somehow being inadequate or tainted, again, it's not presented anywhere below. There was a Curtis advisement. I pointed out in the answer brief, there was, while she was trying to draw her decision to testify into the door issue, the bottom line was she made her decision, she had a Curtis advisement, it was voluntary, and she did not challenge that Curtis advisement in her opening brief.
Well, what do you mean, on the record, did she describe why she was choosing to testify and tying it into the door decision?
She did mention that point. She did, however, primarily complain that her defense counsel didn't fully understand her tempering defense, hadn't gotten her story out, and she needed to get her story out. She needed to say what it was about the tampering in her mind, this conspiracy against her among vendors, employees, and customers of hers. And that was from the very beginning. I mean, there was pretrial discussion about it. It was in the opening statement, and that was her central piece of what she thought was her defense. And the only way that she sought to present it was to testify on her own behalf, and she said as much. And that was the primary reason that she was testifying, was that she wanted to get this evidence in, and she didn't see another way to do so. Turning to 404B, there were different categories of victims, and there were matching categories of 404B non-charge conduct victims. With employees, there was an example of an employee who went to work for her, wasn't paid. When she raised the issue about pay, got complaints about her work, and then was sort of held hostage by Ms. Ryan with regard to her business phone number. There was a similar evidence from a former employee, which was 404B. She went to work, was not paid. When she complained, was retaliated against and had to leave. And this was basically the pattern behavior. The consignment, it was the same thing, only it was a little bit more specific consignment. People would provide her with goods to sell. She was supposed to sell these goods and then receive a percentage for those sales. When she made the sales and did not provide the money and was challenged on this point, she would become very threatening and then immediately say, all your stuff has to be out by tomorrow, and stuff would be returned damaged. There was both a 404B example and, again, a charge conduct example.
Mr. McReynolds?
Yes.
Doesn't this 404B evidence support an independent inference to dispute or to refute the defense of a vast conspiracy?
It does, Your Honor. It shows a pattern of behavior. Because this was in the business context, that was a really important point, because in addition to the internet tampering theory, the other side of the defense theory was that she was just such a bad businesswoman that she had no idea that she was had $500,000 cycling through these accounts in four different names and wasn't placing orders while insisting that she had. And by showing this pattern of behavior where each of these classes of people, customers, vendors, and employees, all had the same experience, it shows the intent to deprive. It shows the pattern of behavior was not, I'm just a bad businesswoman, I took the money and I didn't actually place the order. It was, I took the money and I wasn't placing the order because I was doing other things with the money.
All right, so you're discussing the pattern of behavior, and can you distinguish how that's different from propensity?
Well, I think here we have a very specific pattern of behavior. It's, if you will, a modus operandi or a signature type of crime. Here, the thefts were committed, again, in this business context, where she would ostensibly be engaged in a simple business transaction. For example, I'll order you these $60,000 worth of cabinets, but did not actually have any intent to deliver that product that you ordered. Her intent was instead to take that money and either supply an inferior good if you became trouble, or if you just become such a aggressive, retaliatory person towards you that you would just decide it was too much trouble to go forward. And she did this repeatedly. You know, a good example of the 404B were the Pitts, who had the Snowmass condo. They paid her thousands of dollars, went to go get the work done. She had not even placed orders until months later, after they were firing her and threatening to sue her. And again, it was going far beyond simply, did we have this transaction? Was there a mistake made? It was this pattern of behavior, not of she's a bad person, but she had a game plan. She had a pattern that had worked for her to obtain the money and, for the most part, not ever have to give it back. There are no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. McBurns.
Thank you.
Thank you. I've been thinking about your question about statements versus actions, and I think what it comes to is what the overall focus of Dorr was. Had she taken the stand without the discussions before, the felony conviction comes in to impeach her testimony, to weigh the credibility of her statements, and that's why it's important there were no statements here. And in fact, what she said at the time of her Curtis advisement, and it shows up in there, the judge asked her if they could bring in the felony conviction. Her response on page 241, I think it was on 813, I do, and since that cat is out of the bag. That was the first step right out. And on page 242, she said, I'm doing this of my own free will, but if I had my preference, I would not be testifying.
Ms. Gowdy, doesn't it also come in to dispute or to challenge the credibility of the position that she took?
Not under Rule 806, and Dorr is premised on 806. It's not a statement.
But we do know that hearsay statements for purposes of the hearsay rule include such things as fleeing, running away from the scene of a crime. That's a hearsay statement.
That is true, but the question that was asked by counsel that the judge found Dorr was brought in was the overall subject matter of her context was she believed she had been tampered with. Wasn't that the phrase, her business had been tampered with? That is not a statement of her. That's not her actions by fleeing. It is not something that can bring in something as serious to impeach the credibility of non-testimony as a conviction, a prior conviction in a fairly related area of theft and that.
So you're saying that the defendant can basically avoid the rule by just summarizing the substance of statements rather than relating specific words?
No, I don't think you can avoid the rule, but I think that you can ask about the substance of around why the DA's investigation was going the way it had. This tied in with the fact she had stated Ms. Ryan didn't come and talk to me while she'd been charged. It was going into what had been brought up on direct by that same investigator and the overall context of it. It was not a backdooring of the comments or the statements. And again, it goes to weigh the credibility of the statement. It doesn't go to just say she's got a conviction, because then it's proclivity. It's propensity. Under Dorr, the Kruger case is distinguishable, because that person, the defendant, was pro se. The statements, I believe, in the case were things like, and didn't I say that I wasn't going to have anything to do with this? He put his statements into the direct questions he asked. Kruger is distinguishable. And in Dorr, it was brought up after they elected not to testify. It didn't occur here. This was premature. The case needs to be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gowdy. Thank you again, Mr. McReynolds. Thanks to both counsel for your arguments this morning. We will consider the matter. It is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.